Ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot of excitement in the room. I have to scream to get your attention. Wonderful. Can everyone hear me? Yes. Great. Welcome to this very special first ever book launch of Radical Technologies by Adam Greenfield. We're all really privileged for the first time to hear about this new wonderful piece. My name is Philip Brode. I'm the Executive Director of LSE Cities, a research center here at the London School of Economics, which I run with my colleague Ricky Burdett, and where we focus on global urban change and urbanization. Now, the way we're going to run tonight is we'll have a wonderful, I'm sure, wonderful presentation by Adam, who introduces his book, and we'll then have a Q&A. Now, before handing over to Adam, I wanted to just set the scene very, very briefly by basically linking LSE Cities and Adam and Radical Technologies, which is not an obvious link. And I'll do that using my own radical technology, which is paper. So I think we all need to appreciate the relationship between the kind of technologies we're about to hear about and the city. And there are a couple of points which we can, of course, make. There's the general observation that we tend to nowadays look at a lot of social and economic political change through an urban prism. You could refer to an urban turn, a new urban excitement, and I think it's fair to suggest that it's not only happening in technology studies, but in many other areas where the prism of the city is back. Now, there is also a very special relationship with ICT in particular and the city. Not too long ago, in the 1990s, this relationship was one that may have or has for some suggested that space will be dissolved, that space is no longer of relevance, that it's the end of geography or the death of distance, to quote a few famous books of that era. The idea was simple. If we have the abundance of ICT, we no longer need to be physically connected, we no longer need to come together and congregate the way we do in our cities. Turns out the opposite happened. The last 20 years have seen a dramatic reinforcement of the logics of cities on the basis of and very much connected to the technologies we are seeing about. There's a third point which connects what we're going to hear about tonight and the city, and this relates to a term which we may want to also unpack a bit more, which is solutionism. A lot of this stuff which we're going to hear about is very much dedicated to solving or supposedly solving urban problems, trying to address some of the urgent challenges we are facing in our cities and thereby building a particularly important bridge between the city and these technologies. Tech is also moving back into the city. I.e., where does technological innovation take place? You may have come up or heard of this idea of the re-urbanization of the urban tech ecosystem. So rather than Silicon Valley, the suburban notion of having technology being scaled and used, we are now looking at downtown areas, the Silicon Roundabout here in London, or Silicon Alley in New York, as it was called for some time, are areas where the new technological futures are being certainly thought about, in some cases also scaled. And finally, the city, as always, brings back issues of political power, public life, and ultimately democracy. And I think we'll hear a lot about exactly that point from Adam later tonight. Which brings me to our links. So what brings LSE Cities and Adam together? Very importantly, Adam featured in our Urban Age Electric City Conference in 2012. It was the first time, actually, we had a formal connection, and he provoked all of us and charmed all of us. He gave an excellent overview on why the smart city is not a solution but a problem, why we should be skeptical of it, and that in a room full of people who were actually at the forefront of advocating the smart city model. In fact, all the critical quotes which you use to, in some ways, destroy the myth of the smart city had the representatives in the room, from Siemens to Cisco and all the others. So it was a wonderful moment to get to know Adam, and since then it was a very happy and in some ways increasing connection. Adam then joined us as urban scholar. In fact, the formal title we used was Senior Urban Fellow at LSU Cities from 2013 and 14, and since then has become a very, very reliable, good friend of the center and, of course, a cherished colleague. Now, that brings me to Adam himself and to introduce his CV. I've been at the LSE since 2001. I've attended many lectures. I've also been sort of chairing some of them. I've never been exposed to a CV along the lines I'm going to introduce to you now. It's clearly extraordinary and probably one explanation why Adam is able to write a book like the one we are hearing about. It's not only a combination of extraordinary steps in his life, but each of these steps themselves carry sort of an extraordinary character. He was a rock critic in Seattle in the early 1990s. Now, some of us are old enough to remember what happened in Seattle in the early 1990s. That was certainly a very exciting period. He then was a bike messenger in San Francisco, pretty much the place where bike messaging was, I think, invented as almost a religion. From there, he moved on, and now comes the next page, and that's going to be the shock. The U.S. Army, where Adam was a psychological operations specialist. I don't know whether I'm allowed to disclose where. He was basically flying over North Korea, trying to deal with technology and politics. Well, he then became a lead information architect with Razorfish in Tokyo, which brings us much closer to what we're going to hear about. He was then head of design direction for service and user interface at Nokia in Helsinki. And he is, well, pretty much has from then on developed his passion for writing, first in New York, and is now based in London as a writer and has also been teaching at the Bartlett at UCL in the urban design program. Now, this is his fourth book, and he has published Everywhere, The Dawning Age of Ubiquitous Computing in 2006, then Urban Computing and Its Discontents with Mark Shepard in 2007, and Against the Smart City, which I referred to already, in 2013. So, Adam, this is enough from my end. Over to you.
My goodness, can you hear me? Yeah, good. Wow. Thank you, Philip, for that extraordinarily warm and situating welcome. It's quite a thing to be here to present to a room full of people. I believe maybe a third of you have been at our house. And I think, you know, of that third, probably most of you still have our cat's hair on your clothing. So, hi, everybody. It's great to be here. Tonight's talk is called Radical Technologies, the Design of Everyday Life, which you may have inferred has something to do with this volume here, also coincidentally enough called Radical Technologies, the Design of Everyday Life. How about that? And it's about, broadly, tools that are being presented to us now without thought to whether or not we are going to give our consent to whether we're going to welcome them into our lives. They appear as a fait accompli. They appear as the leading edge of a wave of technological development and futurity that we are being asked to endorse more than think about necessarily. And we're being asked to endorse it by embracing it. We are asked to welcome these things into our lives and accede to the ways in which they transform the physical spaces that we move through, accede to the ways in which they change the conditions of the economy, of the society that we live in, and potentially even the conditions in which we erect these screens or scrims that we think of as selves. So Philip's done a really, really good job of introducing me. I'm not going to say too much more about that, except to say that I've broadly, over the last 10 years or so, 15 years at this point, I think of the domain that I work in as networked urbanism. And I have a very concrete and sort of condensed definition of what that field is. It's simply this. It's a consideration of everyday urban life in the presence of and conditioned by networked digital information technologies. Now that's, bless you, that's, it's important to me that we understand which technologies we're talking about. I have no competence to discuss and will not be engaging with many of the technologies that are bound to have a decisive role in determining the conditions of 21st century life. I have no competence to discuss, for example, biological technologies, anything having to do with science or medicine. I'm not speaking to that. I'm really speaking to the domain of networked digital information technologies. And as Philip has noted, I've mostly pursued these ideas in the guise of theory in the course of four books, including the book that's out today. But I've also had the opportunity, and I think I don't mean to suggest that all theory needs to be grounded in this, but I, for myself, I'm never quite satisfied with my ideas or the arguments that I make unless I have, in fact, grounded them in practice in building things. And so that is something else that I've done over the last 15 years or so. I've actually built networked digital information technologies and attempted to deploy them in cities. What you see on the screen is an example of that. I find most technologies that are intended for urban use far too aggressive, far too heroic and ambitious. What I designed here and actually took out a patent on and tried to develop was something a lot more humble. How many of you have had the situation where, you know, you've got money on your Oyster card and you go and you're running for the tube, you're running for a bus, and you go to tap it on the reader and the red light comes on and this really harsh, irritating buzz sounds and the turnstile remains closed to you. And you're like, wow, I just don't have enough money left on this card. And you have to go back to the machine and fill up the card, and it takes a small but measurable chunk out of your day. It takes, it just adds that little bit of complexity and hassle to our existence. And I thought, you know what? These cards are based on a technology called RFID, radio frequency identification, which means that there's an electromagnetic coil in those cards that is energized when you tap them on the reader. And it turns out, you know, the e-paper displays on a Kindle, those draw really, really small amounts of power. And it turns out that they can be made really thin. They can be laminated onto a card. And it turns out that what you can do is you can actually put a display onto the back of something like an Oyster card that tells you exactly how much money or how much time you have remaining on it. And, you know, this wasn't just something that we sketched up. This was something that we built. This is what it looks like as a prototype, and this is ideally what it would look like in practice. That is not the only dimension of practice that I've been involved with, though. I've also, in a very humble role, been involved with this endeavor. This was Occupy Sandy, a disaster relief and recovery effort that grew up in the wake of Superstorm Sandy in the United States that was a lineal descendant of Occupy Wall Street and used many of that effort's networks and connections and tactics for dealing with this enormous storm that had come to sit over the greater New York area and had been extraordinarily destructive. And one of the things that I learned in the course of this endeavor, you know, it's true, Occupy Sandy ran on technology, but not the heroic technologies that are sold to us by the big technology vendors. Not anything advanced, not anything exotic. It ran on text messages and a shared Google design, a shared Google Doc spreadsheet, and above all, it ran on something that confounds people's expectations, an Amazon.com wedding registry, the registry of Sandy and Sandy, to which people, you know, people would buy gifts for Sandy and Sandy, and then those would get delivered to the church. And, you know, me and hundreds of other people would take the cartons out of the FedEx vans, and we would sort them into pews, and then those would get delivered to people who needed them. This weird hybrid kind of scattershot, kind of flaky, bottom-up, horizontal, self-organized system, it turns out, was extraordinarily more effective at delivering disaster relief and recovery supplies to the most hard-hit communities than either of the canonical organizations, the hierarchical top-down organizations that had been chartered to do this work. On the one hand, the federal government in the guise of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the voluntarist sector, the American Red Cross, the charity that is organized to do these things. So I learned a bunch of things in the course of this practice, not merely the politics of it, but also that at the cutting edge, you know, to use another cliche, where the rubber meets the road, the most effective technologies are very often, again, not at all the ones with high budgets, not at all the ones that are the process of the municipal acquisition process or the product of extraordinary attempts at technological research and development. Very humble, technologies way down the far end of what is called the Gartner hype curve. And so thinking about this relationship between theory and practice in the context of technology, I'm put in mind of a very famous quote. My wife took me for a walk on my birthday last year, and we went walking through Highgate Cemetery, and we came upon this. We came upon, of course, the gravesite of Karl Marx, right? And if you've been to Highgate Cemetery, you'll know that right underneath his chin there is the most famous quote, "Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains." It's at the foot of the grave marker, though, that the quote that really interests me can be found. It's a quote from the Theses on Feuerbach, and it goes a little bit like this. "The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it." Now, this is an idea that in our time has been taken to heart. It hasn't been taken to heart that I know of by any community as fervently, as ambitiously, as passionately as the community of developers in networked digital information technologies, symbolized, epitomized by a guy named Alan Kay. We see here Alan in recent years in his role as elder statesman, holding forth to a fervent and passionate audience in his fervent and passionate way. Alan is famous in the technology community for saying this. He said, "The best way to predict the future is to invent it." So again, the point is to change the world, right? What we're talking about are interested, purposive interventions in the world, which are designed to change the conditions of life. Now, it's interesting that Alan would say this. We should think a little bit about where Alan comes from. He was, for many years, absolutely pivotal, even central, to the effort of a place called Palo Alto Research Center, the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Here's Alan at work in 1974. Now, as the name suggests, Palo Alto Research Center was the research and development campus of the Xerox Corporation. So in that time period, really, none more massive, none more monolithic, except perhaps IBM. I mean, this was the epitome of a certain kind of 1950s, 1960s information technology company, all about serving the corporate market, all about producing large gray boxes that lived in isolation and air-conditioned splendor, where priesthoods of authorized attendants would wait upon them and do their time-sharing routines. What happened at Xerox PARC was to change the history of computing forever, and therefore, very much, are the possibilities that we confront, and in fact, our world. At Xerox PARC, they invented things like the graphical user interface, the retinue of the window and the mouse and the pointer that we all used to interact with devices like this one. I mean, I should say that they were invented by Doug Engelbart in 1968, but they were really developed at PARC. Including the machine that Alan's got there, which a guy named Steve Jobs walked into that office at one point and saw what was going on that screen and kind of walked off snickering, and several years later came out with a device called the Macintosh. So that gives you an idea of the impact this had. But the really important thing about this picture is the keyboard in the foreground. What that symbolizes is what really and truly set PARC apart from every other corporate research and development facility in the world. And I believe what allowed it to become what an author has called dealers of lightning. They really were quite Promethean in the ability to harness the raw power of creativity and offer it to people in the form of technology. What was that? They were immersed in the 1960s Bay Area counterculture. They themselves partook of that counterculture. PARC itself was a place where philosophers, musicians, artists, they had an artist in residence. This was absolutely unheard of for a facility of this type in that time period. It was a place that was suffused by a very distinct set of values. One of those values was liberation, the quest for human liberation, as understood in the Bay Area in the 1960s, here symbolized by a book I suspect many of you will be familiar with, The Whole Earth Catalog of 1968, very famously founded by Stuart Brand, one of the merry tricksters. The Whole Earth Catalog, its tagline was access to tools and information, and it was kind of like the internet in a book. It was a place where you could go and find out about social movements, about how to grow organic farming and organic food, about how to build a dome, about how to liberate yourself from the top-down systems that delivered virtually everything an American consumer of the late 1960s and early 1970s was expected to encounter in their everyday lives. This ethos of liberation was really central to the work of Alan Kay and people like him. It wasn't just that they were interested in liberation, though, they were also interested in deliberation. I'm going to ask for a show of hands. Does anybody in this room, not you, know what this image represents? Show of hands. Okay. This, you'll see from the date here, dates to 1972. This is the control room of an amazing project, something called Proyecto Cinco, or in English, Project Cybersyn, that the great British cybernetician Stafford Beer built for the socialist government of Salvador Allende in Chile between 1971 and 1973. It turns out that when the Allende government came to power, they discovered a warehouse full of teletypewriters that were basically ordered under the previous government and were sitting gathering dust. And they desperately wanted to get a real-time picture of the national economy, of supply and demand and the movements of need and desire throughout the economy. What Beer did was brilliant. He basically made a network of these teletype printers. He installed them in factories. He installed them in schools. He installed them in warehouses. He installed them in places where signals from the economy would eventuate. And all of those signals were brought together into this room to give the people working here, at least nominally, a real-time picture of what was happening in the Chilean economy so they could intervene. But the really important thing about this picture is that Beer had arranged these control seats in a circle, because this was not meant to be a command and control relationship. It was meant to be a discussion, a comradely discussion between the people generating those signals and their representatives in government, between technology and humanity, between each of the people sitting at these seats. This experiment was brought to a halt only by the CIA coup of September 11, 1973, and the bombing of the Federal Palace. So it's not like we ever really got a chance to test this set of propositions. And I think it's a real shame that this branch of history was truncated by violence. Nevertheless, this was the sort of mood that was in the air at Park. It was a time where technology was used immediately at its acquisition by ordinary people to mount challenges to power. This is a collective called Ant Farm, who immediately upon acquiring the big Sony Portapack video cameras, devised a way to pack that equipment into the back of a van and go around to places where ordinary people worked and interview them and bring for the first time the voices of the completely quotidian, ordinary working life of America to the screen in a way in which people could communicate with one another. Here's another view of them, Ant Farm from 1970. I personally think they look a little bit like Scooby-Doo and the gang, but you know, nevertheless, these guys would not look out of place on, say, Red Church Street in Shoreditch at this very moment. They were unusually stylish for their time, and I think the color scheme on the van is amazing. It was a time of interest in not merely individual but collective approaches to technology, here symbolized by an illustration. Again, I'm indebted to Nick for turning this illustration up. From the book that inspires the title of my book, a compendium that was issued in 1976 of a radical British magazine, there were a series of six legendary illustrations by an anarchist illustrator named Clifford Harper. And what he illustrated and envisioned was a time in which ordinary people would take control of the technologies that were available to them, deconstruct them, disassemble them, learn how they worked, repurpose them, turn them towards their own ends, not necessarily their own individual ends, but their collective ends. And what we see illustrated here is a collective of mostly women in an automobile mechanical workshop, learning how to take apart cars and refurbish them and return them to service. It was a time of belief in do-it-yourself, do-it-ourselves. Even before punk rock and that particular wave of interest in DIY, it was a time in which we believed collectively that technology was something that each one of us could break down, disassemble, and understand. I probably don't have to tell you who these two guys are, but I will tell you that before they founded Apple, they were involved with something at Berkeley. You know, the name is a dead giveaway, the Homebrew Computer Club. They believed that computers were something that we could design and develop at home using the tools that we had available to us, just as you might bottle beer. It was a time of belief in the essential harmony of the organic world and the technical world. It was a time when a poem was written by Richard Brautigan, a very famous poem called All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, the idea that we would come to live in a cybernetic meadow where nature and our own interventions interwove so skillfully, so minutely, so granularly that there was no prizing them apart. Here illustrated by an architect named Peter Cook, a member of the Archigram Collective. So, this was the ethos of the Bay Area in the 1960s. This was the ethos that furnished the people who worked at Park with a great deal of their motivation in developing the technologies that they did and offered to the public. You would be forgiven for thinking that this set of aspirations and goals and values and beliefs and motivations would have been decisive in the years that followed, would in fact come to color our own time. But you know what? Something else happened. What happened? Well, a great many things. Bullshit IP law is something that happened. This is in fact a patent that was issued by the United States Patent and Technology Office to Amazon. It's a patent for a curved white background behind a picture. So if you've ever thrown a backdrop behind something that you're trying to photograph in the attempt to make it appear that it's floating in space, as every first-year photography student is taught to do, guess what? Technically, you owe Amazon residuals on that. Walled gardens happened. Instead of the essential and inherent interoperability of our technologies, instead of allowing them to speak the same language, we carved them up into a million balkanized fiefdoms, none of which properly communicated with one another. And we did this so that each one of those could be revenue generating in its own right. As a matter of fact, this revenue generation motivation became so predominant in information technology that it led to the rise of individuals like this. A guy named Nathan Myhrvold, who took his millions that he made at Microsoft. Nathan Myhrvold also, by the way, is the sponsor of an amazing set of cooking books called Modernist Cuisine. So he's not entirely a dirtbag. He has some redeeming features. But, you know, he took all the millions that he made at Microsoft in the early days, aside from sponsoring Modernist Cuisine, you know what he did? He bought up patents. And he literally goes around suing people that he thinks are in violation of those patents. And he gets awarded what are called punitive damages in the United States. He makes quite a good amount of money on this. These are the values that came to typify information technology by the time I came to the table. And so far from generating cybernetic meadows where we gambled in peace with our, you know, natural world, we wound up developing alienation engines. We wound up developing technologies that fractured our worlds, that cut us off from one another, that walled us off behind the screens of our devices, that led us to moments, indeed, of howling fatuity. This is a guy named Robert Scoble. I'm not going to say much more about it, but that he didn't even originally get paid for this. He's kind of a professional fanboy, and he is such a promoter of technology for technology's sake, qua technology, that he went out and he paid $1,500 for Google's Glass augmented reality visor and wore it everywhere for a while, including here very famously in his shower, promoting it. Why, right? Promoting it because it's merely what we do in this time. Technology is now what we do. There is a culture of technology that has become massified, that has become diffused throughout the population in a way that it could not have been in the time of Xerox PARC and Alan Kay. And one of the consequences of that has been an increasing withdrawal of the people who actually make the technology. Weirdly enough, as it becomes more and more normalized, as it becomes more and more simply the ground condition of everyday life, the people who develop it are kind of starting to back away from engagement with the public. They withdraw from all of the systems, services, and environments that characterize the ground of our everyday life. This is a Google bus to Mountain View from downtown San Francisco. People live in San Francisco. You know, they're paid Silicon Valley wages, salaries. They live in San Francisco. They displace the people who might have been able to afford to live in that city otherwise. And then they take the trip down the 101 to Mountain View, where Google is located, not in their own cars, thank God, not even in public transit, but in private air-conditioned buses that are provided with Wi-Fi and security guards and all of that. It is even the beginning of what I would think of as cladistics, of a slow speciation event, the separation of people who have so little in common with the rest of us that at some point they might not even be able to interbreed with us anymore. I would argue that information technology has become, in our time, nothing less than the handmaiden of capital. And so I'm afraid that a lot of what I'm about to tell you has the flavor of the handmaiden's tale. What I'm about to tell you is a story of the post-human everyday, an environment in which emergent technologies increasingly require that the world is engineered physically, socially, institutionally, not so much for our needs, but for its own. That it has, in some sense, become autonomous and self-replicating, and that it replicates according to a logic that, again, has very little to do with our needs, our desires, our abilities, our limits. As we discuss them, I want you to retain this question in mind. What ideologies guide the advent of this post-human everyday? And to what degree do those ideologies have anything in common with the ones that you happen to hold in your heart? We're going to discuss four discrete technologies, and we're going to discuss them bang, 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 bang. Really, this is a super shallow take. If you want to get into more detail, not to pitch the book, but there is a more detailed and more honest account in here. We're going to talk about the Internet of Things. We're going to talk about digital fabrication. We're going to talk a little bit about the blockchain. And finally, we're going to talk about machine learning and artificial intelligence. So, the Internet of Things. What is the Internet of Things? I would forthrightly argue to you that it is nothing less than an imperial effort. It is an effort at the colonization of everyday life by information processing. And it proceeds at three scales. It proceeds at the scale of the body, where we think of it as the quantified self. Will everybody in the room who has like a Fitbit or an Apple Watch on their arm hold it up, please? Yeah, come on, I know some of you have them. Okay, all right, not as many as I suspected. Thank you, that's wonderful. The quantified self. This is an effort to capture and gather the body's own traces, to derive insight from those traces, and to optimize the performance of the human machine. At the scale of the room, of domestic spaces, this effort proceeds under the name of the smart home. You will have seen perhaps yesterday that Apple introduced their own entrant into this market, a place where these devices represent they are the physical avatars of interactive services, which use natural language, voice recognition, and spoken word interfaces to deliver content into your home, but also to collect information. They're always listening. They're literally always listening. They have to be, because they're listening for the watchword. You say, you know, hello, Alexa, or hello, Siri, or hello, Google. They're literally listening for that all the time, which means that they're siphoning up everything that is uttered in the space around them. And guess what happens? Google, or Amazon, or Microsoft owns that data. And they derive enormous value from their ownership of that data, and nothing is offered back to you, the user, except for convenience. You know, can you order a pizza? Yeah, sure, you can order a pizza. What are you giving them? You're giving them information about the time and place of your desire, the shape of your desire, the particular channel through which you prefer that desire be fulfilled. This is the Internet of Things. And so is this, too. Now, I've spoken at LSE before many times about the smart city, and I've, in fact, used this image to describe my take on that. So I'm not really going to get into this into too much detail, except to say that at the scale of the body, at the scale of the room, and at the scale of the city and at public space in general, the desire is the same. The desire is to inscribe networked informatics in every object, surface, and relation of everyday life with an eye towards the computational extraction of value from everyday activity, with an eye towards optimizing performance, either optimizing the performance of the body, optimizing the performance of the domestic machine as a player in the economy and as a role, as an actor in the psychic environment of the family that occupies it, and to optimize ultimately the performance of the city in toto, but against a very weird and particular set of criteria. I mean, those of you who are engineers will know this. You cannot optimize something in the abstract. That is a meaningless statement. You have to optimize against something. You choose to elevate one criterion against others that you may have to sacrifice. If you want to build a very light laptop, for example, you may have to sacrifice a hard drive or the screen size or the size of the battery. So you can't optimize the body, you can't optimize the home, and you certainly can't optimize something as heterogeneous as the city without being explicit about what it is that you're trying to optimize for and what it is that you're willing to trade off against that. None of that ever appears in this discourse. So it's particularly the case that at the scale of the city, what we're looking to do is to model complex urban dynamics ahead of real time, not necessarily for the benefit of those of us who live the city and breathe it and bring it to life. It is so administrators can intervene in anticipation or preemption of events, and I want to emphasize that, administrators. This is not generally an effort to return you the information you need to make wiser choices or better choices or more fruitful choices. It is an effort that is designed to understand your movements, your behaviors, your patterns of association, to do nothing else than control you. So if we are to be generous, which I am not often, but if we are going to be generous and say that this effort is all about sustainability and efficiency and convenience, about preventing waste, about preventing duplication of effort, well, I think it's fair to say that if that was the ambition, that something else happened. And that something else was remote observation and control. When we see these smart city systems installed, what we see is a logic of watchfulness from above, a peculiarly optical way of understanding the complex dynamics of the city. We've known since Jane Jacobs in 1961 that the processes that generate meaning and value in urban experience are not necessarily ones that are amenable to visual inspection. And yet, here is a series of products and services which are predicated on the assumption that to put a camera on something is to understand it. Well, it turns out that that may actually be closer to the truth than it was when it was first proposed. Because it turns out that in our era, sticking a camera on a wall, well, it turns out that you can blow new firmware into that camera. You can equip that camera with new capabilities. You might have bought it off the shelf, and it might not have been capable of this, but years later, you can upgrade its software, and you can turn it into something that's capable of recognizing faces or even doing more aggressive things. So it may finally be possible that we can throw visibility, a cone of visibility over urban affairs and glean insight from them. But I would caution that it is not necessarily the kind of insight that we would be comfortable with. I will give you an example that I've used often at LSE City, so you'll forgive me if I do it again. This is a screenshot that is now several years old. This is from around 2008. So imagine that everything I'm talking about here is old news. Not fake news, just old news, right? But we can do a lot better than this now. Technology can do a lot better than this now. What is going on? What we see here is the feed from a camera that is installed in the mounting frame of a video billboard. It's a camera a lot like the one that's in your mobile phone. So it's really small and really hard to see. And as people move in front of that billboard, the camera is, well, first it's attempting to identify the gender of the people who walk in front of it. So if, you know, you thought that gender was a performance, if you thought that gender was fluid, if you thought that gender was something that was up to the person themselves to decide how to present themselves to the world, guess what? As far as this particular software is concerned, that's not the case. You're either male or female. You're either male or female according to an index of 81 separate measurements of facial bone structure. So you're sorted, you know, binary, black, white, male, female, that's it. And you can see that from the blue and red circles that are on the screen. This software is also attempting to ascertain what age you are to within four bands. It is attempting to use that same measurement of facial bone structure to ascertain what ethnicity you are. And lastly, it is bouncing light off your eyeballs, and by measuring the index of refractivity, it is trying to ascertain whether you're paying attention to the content on the screen. Why is it doing that? Because we are not, all of us, equally valuable to advertisers, and our attention is not equally valuable to advertisers. This software is entirely predicated on entraining the attention of the most valuable audiences. And guess what? If you choose to ignore, I mean, you know, there's no attempt made to inform people that this is taking place. There's no attempt made to acquire anybody's consent for any of this information collection. And even if you're one of these people walking past the billboard in the back there, you're still generating value for the people who run this software and for the people who buy the results from it, because that's, you know, negative data, right? That is a an indication that you're not paying attention. And so perhaps we have to jazz up the ad to entrain and capture your attention. Software like this turns us into material for data analytics. Software like this ultimately turns us into operands, into things that operations are performed on, not people who live the city, not people who have interiority, not people who are subjects, but people who are objects. Here represented by a screenshot, an image that was generated by an advocacy center in Chicago that's dealing with something called the heat list that is organized by the Chicago Police Department. The Chicago Police Department attempts to identify the 1,200 individuals in the city of Chicago who are most likely either to commit or to be victim of handgun violence. And it assigns those 1,200 people a numerical score. And then if your score breaches a certain threshold, the Chicago Police Department goes and knocks on your door. This is called, it's a wonderful Orwellian term for what this is. It's called custom notifications. Now, this is in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution. This is a violation of the guarantee of due process of law. It is unconscionable, but the Chicago Police Department says that it works. So the collection of data from everyday life brought to bear on bodies differentially in the city, this is the purpose of the Internet of Things. And it is becoming normalized in our time. You know, they say the greatest trick the devil ever played was convincing us that he didn't exist. And very similarly, we can say that the greatest trick that neoliberalism ever played on us is convincing us that it is just ordinary, that it is the way things are done, that there is no alternative. And if you buy that, then perhaps you will also buy the argument that this set of technological practices and strategies is very similar in that it is presented to us as merely the way a contemporary city does things efficiently by the vendors responsible who clearly have a financial interest in selling them, but also people in the culture like Robert Scoble who are so invested in this notion that they are living on the cutting edge of futurity that they will insist to you that this is the wisest and the best way to do the city for all of us, no matter where we're from, no matter who we are, what city we live in. That is my account to you of the Internet of Things. Let's talk about a slightly more optimistic set of technologies, digital fabrication. Digital fabrication, which includes things like 3D printing, CNC milling, laser cutting. One of the most interesting things to me about this this stage in time in our collective evolution is that things appear to us as commodities. This is a shoe that was designed by Kanye West. I personally think it's quite a nice shoe, actually. There weren't very many of them made, and they were presented to us as these sort of fetish objects that you were a connoisseur and a bearer of cultural capital if you somehow knew how and where to acquire these. They drop at unspecified times and places. You have to be something of a ferret to know how to get shoes like this. But the strangest thing about this to me is that there's no need for any of this. There's no need for any of the fetishization or the process of the mechanics of scarcity around anything physical, because we now have the means to make things locally and on demand. As a matter of fact, through a process called 3D printing, if you don't want to buy Kanye's shoes for $400 a pop or up, you can make shoes that are biomechanically suited to your own gait, to your own body, and you can produce them for maybe 4 or 5 pounds worth of material. And they can look like whatever you want them to. Right? I, again, happen to think that this aesthetic is kind of cool and might not necessarily be able to get away with it in here, but I'd probably wear those to the gym. And the thing is that this begins to undercut the entire logic of scarcity that the material flows of the economy are predicated on. It begins to rethink what it is to be a means of production. This is something called the RepRap. This is one of the early 3D printers. It was developed by a guy named Adrian Bowyer, an engineering professor. And, you know, like every other 3D printer in existence, the way it works is this. It takes plastic filament, and it melts it through a printhead that moves back and forth on a stage. Well, you can see how big that stage is. So anything that you can get a digital design file for and port that file to this printer, you can produce And as long as you don't mind that thing being made of kind of a faintly greasy plastic, you can have anything you want. This is, in a very real sense, and accepting that there are costs that we're not discussing of energy and assembly labor and all of that, this is a means of production. It's something more than that, though. It's a distributed means of production. This was Adrian Bronier's original idea. There he is getting kind of cut off by the screen over there. He argued that the very first thing that anybody would do with a rep wrap is immediately produce the parts for another, right? And this is, in fact, the historical case that's being illustrated here. This was the first rep wrap, and that's the second. And his idea was that we would, each one of us, make one of these things as soon as we got one and give it to our neighbor for nothing. And that there would be so many of these things in the world that the productive material capacity of our culture would be massively, massively liberated from any question of scarcity whatsoever. And this begins to suggest a fairly radical and interesting picture, a picture in which digital fabrication technologies used with repositories of freely downloadable specifications, so design patterns for anything that you can imagine, which are available free online, and in fact they are, that are deployed in clean city center workshops, so not out on the distant outskirts of town, but close to where people live and work and where they need things. And if those workshops could be under democratic community control, well, you could make some really interesting things happen. One of the things you could make happen is this. You could reinstill an ethic of repair into everyday life. So this is an internal combustion engine in a lawnmower that had fallen out of service. And it had fallen out of service because this component here had vibrated away and just been thrown away. It's called a motor mount. It turns out that somebody was able to find the design pattern for this motor mount on one of these repositories, print it out for, I don't know, a pound's worth of plastic. And instead of junking this entire internal combustion engine, they were able to return the whole thing to service. Now, okay, put your feelings about internal combustion engines to the side. I have the same feelings that you do. The idea here, though, is that there's a sunk investment of capital and energy in that internal combustion engine that would have gone to naught. It would have been wasted and dispensed with. It would have been junk. It would have been landfill. But for this printer, which returned the whole thing to active service, not merely an ethic of repair could be instilled, but an ethic of self-reliance. Here are activists for something called the Red Hook Initiative. It's an amazing project in Brooklyn that I urge you to look up. They are installing an ad hoc wireless network in their community, and they're doing it themselves, independently of the corporations that want to sell them internet connectivity. But, excuse me, in order to do so, they have to buy these antenna masts. And, you know, their funding comes from the philanthropic sector for the most part. So, you know, they're reasonably well-resourced. But you know what? If this thing costs $150 or so, that's a chunk out of their operating budget, and that limits the amount of these things that they can put up, limits what they can do. What if instead of going to the Rockefeller Foundation or the Ford Foundation and asking for the budget to go buy these things, they could print out the antenna mast themselves? They could measure the antenna, they could measure the rooftop, they could print a bespoke antenna mast, maybe at most for $10, right? They could rely upon their own resources, their own capabilities. What happens ultimately is that our need for satisfaction via the market is replaced by something the psychologists call an internal locus of control. So instead of thinking the world as something which happens to us and which we're compelled to passively absorb, we become active agents and creators of our own realities. Now, this is already happening to a very great degree. This is a 3D printer that does not work with melted plastic filament. It works with wet concrete. And it works, as you can see here in Shanghai, at building scale. So this building, housing, was produced maybe in 2 or 3 hours, right? So this is a fairly utopian trajectory. This is an amazing set of potentials, set of possibilities that are folded up in this envelope. You would think that the world would begin to reflect the anti-scarcity mechanics of the rapid replication project and the liberation from material scarcity that's embedded in it. But once again, something else happened. Turns out that people do not want to buy Tinker Toy-looking things that they have to build themselves. They'd rather buy 3D printers as products made in China and shipped to them over the ocean. And you can see here what they build with those 3D printers. They do not build for the most part, machine components or replacement hip joints or models of the clitoris so people can learn about the body. They build little bunnies. So maybe it turns out to be a good thing that the world did not turn out the way that Adrian Bowyer and people like him anticipated. Because, look, think about it this way. What gets disrupted when you deliver a capability like this into a community might be an ecosystem that functions in a way that's opaque to the innovator. In this slum community, these guys derive their entire livelihood, and more than their livelihood, their sense of identity, their sense of importance, from being the people that when a storm comes through and blows the roof off of these shacks, they're the guys that go find the plastic tarp or the aluminum sheeting or whatever it is that allows people to literally sleep with a roof over their heads. These are the guys in that community that do that. When you come and you drop a 3D printer in their community that builds entire shacks in an hour's time, okay, yeah, you're probably upgrading the material standard of living, but you're disrupting a social ecology. And very, very few people are talking about that or what to do about it. It remains the case that these devices don't come cheap. They're still, like a CNC milling machine, a desktop one, $1,500 US. 3D printer, $1,000 US. You can now get, you know, at Hanley's, you can now get a mini 3D printer for something like £300, but can't do anything with it. So still, orders of magnitude beyond where they would need to be in order to be embraced by people. The entire technology assumes an advanced knowledge base. You cannot simply airdrop these into places and have them autonomously set up and self-working. You have to have somebody who's really, you know, skilled with the building of the components in their assembly. And of course, for those of you who are immersed in this culture, you will understand that the notion of open source and free licenses is deeply contested terrain. There's no such thing as an open source license. You have to specify exactly what you mean. And the tensions in this community around the notion of freely licensing these design patterns was such that it tore the early MakerBot community apart entirely. So the people who did the most to innovate this space no longer speak to each other because they have differing religious beliefs about, you know, well, is it open source or is it free software? So the result is 3D technology, 3D printing technology exists in our time. This is, in fact, a 3D printed shoe. It's an Adidas. But ironically enough, it exists in our life as a fetish object. This shoe is not less but more expensive than an ordinary Adidas sneaker. It is being marketed as being 3D printed and therefore even more special than the Kanye West sneaker, harder to find, and more fetishized. So something else happened. I happen to think this is a nice shoe. I'm going to skip over the blockchain section because it really is complicated. And really, the blockchain is probably the first technology I've encountered in my adult life that just confounds the ability of otherwise perfectly intelligent people to get it on first exposure. It's something that you have to kind of sit with for a while before it makes any sense. What I will say to you about the blockchain is that, again, it was designed to be liberatory and something else happened. Okay? Just hold on to that for now. We'll come back to it. Yes, it's contracts all the way down, not liberation, but erosion. Yeah, this would have been interesting to talk about. Corporations instantiated as self-directing software. That's a good one. Let us talk about artificial intelligence and machine learning and what happens when they come together, and particularly what happens when they come together with so-called big data. We move decisively toward the post-human. A year and a half ago, I saw this map when I was doing my morning web surfing. Is this familiar to you? Have you seen this map? Yeah. This is a map of the most frequently held jobs in each of the 50 United States. And so there are methodological problems with this map. I don't want to argue that this is a high fidelity representation of the social and economic reality of the United States. It is, however, strongly suggestive. And one of the things that it conveyed to people, which I think surprised a great many people, is that many households in the United States, the primary wage earner is employed as a truck driver. Why is that of interest to us here? Well, it's of interest because think of how much hype you read about autonomous vehicles, driverless Ubers, robot cars cruising the streets of the city. And then consider that the performance regime of long-distance trucking is infinitely simpler than what you would have to reckon with to develop a car that was able to navigate the city autonomously. It is much, much easier to develop an autonomous truck than it is to develop an autonomous car. And then think what happens to the economy when all of those wage earners, all of those heads of families and heads of households have their jobs automated out from under them, have their entire ability to generate value for the world turned into a portable instruction set, a compact module of software which can be transmitted across the internet and can come to reside in any machine which is materially capable of enacting its instructions. It is not merely truck drivers that this is now happening to. Because when we think about it, pattern recognition, hold your question to the end if you would.
Just a little bit of context, there's about 3.5 million truck drivers in the US right now and 300,000 cabbies. So within 18 months, about half of those will probably go. Just add some context.
Okay, hold on to the comment until the end, thank you. It is not merely cabbies or truck drivers that this is happening to, because it turns out that if you consider, and this hurt me to realize, I wrestled with this for a long time, pattern recognition is at the core of most human expressive activity. And what big data and software analytics together are good for is pattern recognition. So it's not merely learning how to pilot a vehicle, it is being a lawyer or a doctor or a creative director at an advertising agency, or a great singer. These things, too, are now capable of being abstracted and recomposed as portable instruction sets. What we move towards decisively is the eclipse of human discretion. This is a master of the Japanese art of aedo, drawing the sword. That is a Motoman MH24 industrial palletizing robot. For some reason, the Yaskawa Corporation, who makes the Motoman, decided that it would be wise to have the Swordmaster garbed in a motion capture bodysuit and to perform all of the movements of his art that he had spent 24 years of his life training in, to turn those into algorithms and to port them to the MH24. And now that robot can perform the 10,000 cuts not as well as he can, but better, because it will not tire, it will not stop, it will cut and cut and cut until the edge of its blade is worn away by friction with the air. We move towards the eclipse of human discretion. This is an image from the next Rembrandt project. The entire corpus of known and verified Rembrandts was analyzed for the metrics that composed the figures and the subjects of these paintings. The decisive subject of a Rembrandt is a male in his early 30s looking over his right shoulder, for example. All of these metrics were garnered, they were analyzed, and they were used to produce an image that had never before existed on Earth, the image that you see here. If you took this image, and mind you, this was not pixelated, this is something that was layered down by 3D printing, right? This is a physical image, has texture. All of these like screen lines over it are not part of the image. If you took this painting and you shuffled it, who was that? This is mighty disturbing. Not even, okay. Let's see if that happens again. If you took this image and you shuffled it back into the deck of known Rembrandts, I wouldn't have the new to sort it out and say this is the one that was painted by an algorithm. It fools me, at least. Maybe you're an art historian, maybe you're a scholar of fine art, maybe you would be able to identify it. I wouldn't. We move towards a world into which even the highest aspirational goals of human expression are capable of being turned into algorithmic rule sets and propagated across the network. We live on the verge of a world tuned not for our own intelligence, our own desires, but for another kind of intelligence. This is a load-bearing bracket that has had an algorithmic process of topological optimization applied to it, right? So it was a load-bearing bracket such as you might find at a hardware store, which we would all recognize. We see them 500 to a bucket. You would see them and you would know immediately what it was for and what to do with it. After this process has been applied to it, it looks Lovecraftian. I even find it faintly disturbing. And yet it is millimeter for millimeter and atom for atom far better than anything we would have designed ourselves. It has a much higher strength to weight ratio. It will outperform anything that we ever design. And yet I don't know that I, myself, at the age that I am now, can necessarily reckon with these objects. So when we say that we introduce these processes into our world with the idea of reducing drudgery or enhancing safety or even eliminating bias, we must remember that in these technological endeavors, very frequently something else happens. Something else happens perennially. We find ourselves in terra incognita. We find ourselves at the edge, truly, of the unknown. Because it turns out that the world's complexity confounds design early intention. It turns out that there are all kinds of systems and processes that await to ensnare the unwary inventor. You cannot predict the future by inventing it. You can deploy technologies into the world, and you can await to see what the world does with them. Very often they are ensnared by what the philosopher Jane Bennett refers to as the material recalcitrance of social conditions. So much for interested purposive intervention in the world. And a further circumstance awaits, which is that we do not merely receive and experience discrete technologies, but converged ensembles. So imagine that an artificial intelligence that is instantiated as a corporation that lives in software, has control of 3D printing, and is building objects for everyday life according to its own aesthetic needs. In such circumstances, all bets are off, and our categories are broken. Particularly when we enter an economy that is decoupled from human labor, an economy which is decoupled from human desire, and an economy which is decoupled from human accounting of worth, we have a post-human economy. We have entered truly the transvaluation of all values. And we need to understand now, we no longer understand the yardstick of worth in this world. We do not have a particularly good idea of what the world looks like when the means of production is owned by autonomous software. And particularly, we need to confront the idea, what is there left for the unnecessariat to do? The unnecessariat meaning us. What of meaning and value and worth is there left for us in this world? A post-human economy requires a post-human politics. We need to understand that we cannot renounce this set of possibilities. They're coming upon us too fast, and we have too few levers to affect their embrace and their adoption by the institutions of state and of culture that surround us. But there may be a place for tactics. There may be a place for tactics. We need to decide how we can enact the conditions of justice in such circumstances, and how we can build a home for the human and a place to dwell upon the earth in a world that is very, very rapidly absconding from our understanding. I thank you very much for your time and your patience and your attention and your energy, and I am here to answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Adam. I'm sure you have woken us up in sort of the most indirect and direct sense of the phrase. So we don't have a lot of time.
Sorry.
20 minutes to be precise. And I really want to take the opportunity to cover as many questions there may be in the audience as possible. So what we want to do is not to have statements, but really questions for Adam, which we'll pool in maybe groups of three. And if you ideally sort of link your questions or wait until your questions comes up in the context of maybe broader bundles which we're going to discuss, maybe related to some of the different technologies, but also maybe related to the much broader philosophical questions which have been phrased. So the first person can just shoot, ask whatever question. I'll then take two more, hopefully related ones. And don't be shy. And if you could very briefly say who you are, that would also be helpful. Damu.
Damu Radeshwar. With the population of the world becoming 7 billion and increasing at a rapid rate, what do you think is going to happen?
OK. Okay, population. Dan was one of our participants in the executive masters in cities. Anyone else? Sort of big contextual question. Top there, please. Just very briefly say who you are.
Ivor. Just my question about, given the context of politicians between he who should not be named and Trump and Theresa May and even Ian Duncan Smith talking about cyber, who is really tackling this new politics, this post-human politics?
Okay. And the third one, please. Over there. Very back.
Sarah, I'm curious about, I think whenever we think about machine learning, whenever we think about like the rise of the robots, there's always that piece that's, it's really the rise of the algorithm, right? I think there's a massive piece there around intent. And I thought it was really interesting when you were talking about Park, you know, context, my dad was a developer in that era. I work for Google, it's a bit complicated. And I think, you know, we forget that ARPANET was created by DARPA, kind of funded by this complicated, tense public-private corporation. I'd love to hear more about your thinking around intent. Are we at a place now where anybody can build ethically? I'm just curious about that macro question around AI and that piece. I'm just thinking of somebody once said to me, if I can build it, do I have a duty to build it?
Yes.
And I'm just really interested in that space.
Fantastic. Thank you. Great questions. Goodness, population. My understanding is that the population of the planet is now beyond 8 billion. I don't think it's even 7 billion anymore. So I think that we're in even more trouble than your figures suggest. The trouble is that, as far as I can tell, there's no ethical way to begin to address that situation other than to choose not to have children one's own self. I think anything else shades very quickly into frankly, racist terrain, and you get the worst sort of people talking about population hygiene very quickly, and measures, you know, regrettable measures that we would have to take to preserve the ecology of the planet. If you study this area, it is millimeters beneath the surface. So I, to be frank with you, do not see the survival of the long-term survival of a highly energy-intensive high-numbered population on this planet of human beings. I just do not. I believe that we are in the penumbra of human time and that we will not exist as a highly organized species for very, very much longer. So what does one do under those circumstances? Well, if you're me, one writes a book about it, and that is, in fact, the topic of my next book called At the End of the World, Plant a Tree, Practices for the End of Human Time. Okay, so, right, that's
questions.
Right. We want to answer after that
Let's
right.
go to those.
The question about politics and who's engaging this. Well, do you know The Accelerationist Reader? Are you familiar with that book? That's a really good place to start in terms of understanding the people who have, even for 15 or even 20 years now, have begun to wrap their heads or anticipate or even steer some of the sets of conditions that I'm talking about. Wildly, wildly problematic terrain, again. You know, there is a left accelerationism, but there is predominantly a right accelerationism. And it shades into what has been called the Dark Enlightenment or neo-monarchical thought. Very, very interesting, very fruitful lines of inquiry that bear virtually no resemblance to the politics that we see on the BBC and the monitors at the gym when we're doing the elliptical, and it says that Jeremy Corbyn is saying this about Theresa May, and, oh yeah, that guy from the Lib Dems has said something stupid as well. The politics that I'm increasingly immersed in is a politics which, weirdly and regrettably, is almost incoherent to anybody that hasn't sort of mastered a body of assumptions that have to do with different organizing strategies that become possible once somebody thinks of themselves as a networked self. And so it's very difficult to talk about those practices and not have people think that you're fucking nuts. right? That happens to me a lot. But if you go and you immerse yourself, it's called hashtag accelerate, the accelerationist reader. And be careful, because again, you know, there be monsters for sure. But I think you'll find that there are people in there who are starting to think these problems through in a way that mainstream conventional consensus political discourse has not yet. I hope those are reasonable answers to those questions. And to your question, intent. I think that there are two processes going on that make this a very interesting time for designers and creators. One of the processes is the massive explosion, distribution, and democratization of capabilities. So virtually anybody with access to what's called Shanzhai Manufacturer and a Kickstarter account can sort of put together a fairly professional product in very short order and sell it into the world. And that's at the level of hardware. Atoms being so much harder to organize than bits, the parallel process is also true, that there is a massive democratization of access to things like code libraries and the ability to extend earlier innovations and developments relatively modularly, which means that many, many, many more people are now empowered to make either software tools or actual physical material hardware tools than ever have been before. My take on that, so my first book in 2006 was an attempt to articulate a set of ethical guidelines for the development of ubiquitous computing. There were five guidelines. And even at that time, I was conscious that the decision nexus that those guidelines were addressed to was sort of exploding and demassifying. There isn't really a center of mass anymore that you can appeal to and say, can we consensus on what our ethics collectively looks like, and can we consensus about ways in which we're going to enact those ethics in the world? So what I see happening is actually the opposite of what I think you were getting at in your question. I think that there is no such thing as taste anymore, and there's no such thing as ethical development anymore. The capability is so widely distributed that all of these questions are moot. Anybody can, practically speaking, develop whatever they want, whether or not we would think that's a particularly wise or healthy thing to have in the world. You know, people are already developing lethal autonomous robotics. And I mean outside the context of DARPA. I mean people who are kind of just doing this as a startup in the thought that they're going to get flipped to a larger organization or funded by somebody else. People are already developing humanoid robotics to supplant human care workers, human sex workers. These are things which I personally am not comfortable with at all, but there's absolutely no way to regulate that, because to me it feels like the genie is decisively out of the bottle. People of every culture, people of every background, people of every physical location on Earth are now developing with high technologies in accordance to their own lights. And I find that prospect kind of darkly thrilling. There is, you know, sort of a dark sublimity to it. Because again, it does mean that all bets are off. But to me, as sort of a modernist and somebody who believes in the possibility that we could consensus on a set of behaviors that we might want to observe and embrace and uphold, I don't think that's possible anymore. I just do not. And I'm happy to discuss that all at greater length, but I hope that's been sort of an adequate approach to an answer to a question.
Thank you. Another round. Let's start here and go up. Please, Hastings.
Thank you so much. Hastings Chikoko from Johannesburg with the Executive Masters Program. I just want to get your comment on what is happening in the music industry. You've talked about the evolution of technology, talking about Internet of Things and stuff. But we also are noticing the return of old technology. We have moved from the record of vinyl to cassette tape to CD to MP3 to Spotify, iTunes, and now the vinyl is back. The cassette tape is coming back. What does that tell us within the context of radical technologies?
Thank you very much. And Andrew, just higher up.
Hi, Andrew Davies from Toronto, also with the Executive Master's course. What is your relationship like with your phone? And how has your experience in the military affected that?
And then we have Fizza in the top, please.
Hi, I'm Fizza. I'm a researcher at LSE Cities. You mentioned that the greatest trick is that there's no alternative, and we think that a city that relies on technology is one that's really efficient. So I was just wondering, what is the process through which that becomes common sense and something that we give our consent to as well, and also more broadly, sort of why and how does something else keep happening?
Those are all great questions. The return of vinyl, I think, is about nostalgia. I think it's about nostalgia on the part of people like me, who remember the most intense and the most vivid moments of our lives were moments that are tightly bound together in memory with things like vinyl records and mixtapes. And I think there's enough of an aura around those artifacts that we've successfully communicated that aura to successive generations. We have successfully inculcated those objects with the power to bear enhanced meaning. But I think, and I'm sure somebody in the room will correct me if I'm wrong about this, that and I hate that I'm using this as a metric, and I hate myself for making this argument, but I think if you compare the size of the market for turntables, the size of the market for, certainly for cassette players or for Polaroid film cameras or for any of these other kind of revenant artifacts which come back to us, to the size of the conventional digital markets that fuel the desires and the demands of the mass market, I think you'll find that they're just the tiniest little blip on the radar. And furthermore, that they are as subject to the whims of fashion as anything else. I do not think that the turntable is necessarily back to stay. I think we're in a cultural moment. And in fairness, and you know, if you argued to me that, yeah, this cultural moment has lasted 12 years now, you know, 15 years now, decent amount of time to be talking about, you know, something which is supposedly the Walking Dead. You know, you might be able to convince me otherwise, but my gut tells me that these are really gestures that we're making against our own fear, and that there are things that we hold up to convince ourselves that we still live in a habitus of that has the value that we remember from the pre-digital world. That's my gut take. What is my relationship with my phone like, and how does my experience in the military affect that? Well, I understand our phones as surrogate organs. I talk about this in the book. You know, in this almost kind of Cronenbergian, like, body horror sense. They're network organs. Like, we weren't born with organs that allow us to perceive the pulsations of the network, so we've had to graft onto ourselves these devices that give us that capability. And most of us, it almost literally is a graft. And to be honest, I'm not very much different. I'm terrible at OPSEC, right? I do not think about InfoSec. Of course I think about it. But do I perceive it as a threat vector, and do I take actions to minimize the impact of that threat vector on my everyday activities? I do not. And that's as conscious as it sounds. It is a conscious choice. Because I don't want to live afraid, and I don't want to perceive the world the way a lot of my friends in InfoSec do, which is this sort of cultivated paranoia is the way that they make their living, and it is how they come to live their lives. And I've seen what that does to people, and I don't like the kind of subjectivity that tends to generate. So I am throwing myself open to the network and making myself very deliberately vulnerable to the downside of that. But in so doing, I get to manifest the upside of that as well. How do these things become common sense? I subscribe to a kind of an old school Chomskyan discourse policing notion about this. I think that there are still kind of heavyweight media actors. And so when somebody like the BBC does features on smart cities, and they present it as just like, wow, this is the wave of tomorrow. Let's go to Singapore and look at the super trees in the harbor, right? Does everybody know that story? Does everybody know about the super trees, right? And they say, well, you know, look, they shelter us from the sun, and they make it moist underneath, and they collect energy. And I happen to think, you know what else shelters us from the sun and collects energy and makes it moist underneath? A tree. And you know what else? Trees reproduce themselves, right? Trees are awesome, right? So, you know, when the BBC or CNN or the New York Times falls all over themselves to completely uncritically and also notice where these things are situated, right? It happens to be the case that the advanced technologies that Western cities are supposed to embrace are ordinarily located in authoritarian countries, right? With top-down command and control relations and the ability to mandate what technologies are instilled in everyday life. So all of these things are sort of pushed to the side. And then, you know, Philip was very generous in suggesting that those of us who had argued against the smart city had any impact at all. I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think that you know, the proteins on the surface of a virus adapt and evolve, and it is the same way with the smart city. When we delivered this sort of frontal argument against the smart city, well, the proteins evolved, and now they say, well, we weren't really talking about smart cities. No, we were talking about smart citizens. We want to make people smart, because of course, cities can't be smart. And the discourse evolves, but it carries the same payload. And the payload is really a bunch of fairly conventional technologies that are sold by fairly conventional vendors who are really interested in enhancing their bottom line, and their media partners who are always happy to tell a story about tomorrow. And I think that's a fairly conventional and a fairly well-understood dynamic. I don't think there's anything special about this. Watch how quickly you're marginalized if you go into one of these contexts and start telling other stories. Watch how quickly it is suggested that you are not a serious person and you do not have serious contributions to make. It's dramatic. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Final round, Eduardo, and then anyone here? Yes, and then anyone on this side? Adam, great.
Roberto from Rio de Janeiro and from LSC Cities also. How about hackers in this context? They are the resistance, or they are just part of the process?
Good question.
Hi, I'm Anna. So I was reading kind of a book on the history of technology and how, when we made the move from like an oral culture to a literary culture, so as people had to learn how to read, in the beginning, not a lot of people knew how to write, so they had scribes, so they would tell the scribes what to write. But then more and more people learned to read and write. And then now we kind of moving from like a literary culture to sort of a digital one, I think. I mean, these are just my thoughts. So more and more people are learning how to code. And at the moment, a small group of people know how to code, but kids are learning in school, so more people are learning. So my question is sort of, as someone who doesn't know how to code, if we choose not to learn how to code, are we kind of becoming digitally illiterate? Are we about to be eclipsed by like the younger generation? That's my question.
Great question.
Adam, please.
Hi, I'm Adam from LSC Cities. Quick question is about automation. I was at a conference where there was a kind of technophilic debate, and Nicholas Negroponte from the MIT Media Lab was suggesting that the fear of automation and the lack of jobs is because we have a very narrow understanding about what a job is, and that the fear of losing those jobs depends on a very recent history of wage labor. So just a response to that, maybe.
Okay, groovy. Hackers, you know, hackers. Wow. I know and work with a lot of people who would probably think of themselves and call themselves hackers, so I need to be careful how I answer this. No, absolutely not. I haven't coded a line since 1984. I was a little bit younger than you were. Not much. I think this myth, and it is a myth, of the individual, autonomous, anarchic, empowered person who has leveraged technology to be able to act asymmetrically and with consequence against larger institutional actors, whether state or non-state, is not borne out historically. And this is the desired end state for a great many of these people, that they wind up being employed in the very organizations and institutions that they sought to undermine when they were younger. And they cultivate in the process of attacking those systems an ethos and a mindset that is similar to InfoSec people. It is arcane. It is, to me, just sort of aesthetically unappealing. It's personal judgment. And I don't ultimately hold a whole lot. You know, we used to believe that perhaps, you know, Anonymous would be a counterweight to the actions of the federal government. Now, it's foolish to count on Anonymous in any way, shape, or form, as you know, because anybody who wants to call themselves Anonymous can be an Anon. So, there are a million Anonymouses. And what we've seen is that all of their ops, all of their attempts to address institutional power through the use of so-called hacking techniques, devastating failures, embarrassments, really. And so, you know, I grew up with that. You know, I saw War Games, too. I wanted to be that guy, David Lightman. I even remember the character's name, right? I wanted to master these systems and understand their dark ways and learn how to turn them towards my own ends and according to the lights of my own politics. And I think a lot of other people did as well. But I think people who are really motivated along those lines wind up, generally speaking, captured by the processes that they seek to subvert, psychically, if not factually. That has been my experience. You asked 15 different questions in that extraordinarily condensed package, which is amazing. I will answer the last one that you asked, which was about should everybody learn to code, and if you do not learn to code, are you going to be left behind? I think there are two ways of answering that. The first thing is, I think it's a disaster to propose that everybody learns to code, because learning how to code in the human repertoire is like any other skill. Some people have the propensity for it, and some people do not. You know, do I believe everybody should be exposed to code? Yes, in the same way that I believe everybody should be exposed to the prospect of learning how to play a musical instrument, to the same way I think everybody should be exposed to the prospect of learning to live freely in their bodies. But we do not all have an equivalent physical intelligence. We do not all have an equivalent social intelligence. We do not all have an equivalent musical or linguistic or social intelligence. And I would propose to you that coding is like that. It's for some people and very much not for others. So I think that it's one of these cosmetic, hygienic things that politicians who don't really understand technology very well tend to propose, because it's a Band-Aid that they can slap on things. And they can say, well, you know, code is what runs the new economy, so we should all learn to master that. And I think that's fatuous. I really do. Which is not to say that you're not being left behind. And this is the second and scarier part of the answer. You are being left behind, but not by human coders. You're being left behind by autonomous, we'll call them artificial intelligences. They're learning how to code artificial intelligences. And what happens in a deep learning process, in a convoluted neural network, is not amenable to human understanding. We cannot later unpack it and say, well, this is how it arrived at this outcome. This is the reasoning process. This is the pathway of decisions that it made to produce this artifact. It really is a black box to us. We can't reverse engineer it. We can only kind of evaluate the outcomes. And so increasingly, I read this just the other day, and it startled me with how early it had appeared. Google is already using the outputs from its previous generation of AlphaGo artificial intelligences to design the next generation. And kind of like with the palletizing robot and the Swordmaster, That artificial intelligence is working all the time. It is iterating furiously, and it's learning as it goes. Its results, at some point, seem to me likely to become asymptotic, right? It will accelerate until the developmental curve is nearly vertical. This is what technologists call the singularity. I do not believe in the singularity as they articulate it, because ultimately for them it's a kind of a wish fulfillment. It's a kind of a very adolescent wish fulfillment, and I don't think they understand very well what they're actually wishing for. But I do think that at some point, and actually fairly soon, these processes will decisively abscond from our ability to understand them. And they will be driving the economy. And they will be driving things like the rationing of healthcare. And they will be driving material and energetic circulations that we will not understand. So yeah, feel that you're being outpaced, but don't think that you're being outpaced by the people on either side of you or by any other human person. Automation, my friend. I think that our understanding of what a job is, I hate to cede any ground at all to Nicholas Negroponte, who I think is probably more than most individuals responsible for the crisis that we find ourselves in, and is, go look up the history of the Negroponte family sometime if you really want to understand some deep state shit. I think, again, you know, the kind of consensus discussions that we have, particularly in the media, but also in everyday life, about the economy and about, you know, well, we got to save jobs. We need good jobs. It collapses a couple of different dimensions of really very different things. It collapses the notion of labor and the notion of value creation and the notion of economic participation. And those are just sort of sandwiched together in this very pat idea. Job, which I agree with him and I agree with you, is, I don't know, 150 years old maybe. That's just not the way that value, or for that matter, matter or energy are going to be transducted in any economy that I can imagine emerging within the next several years. We need to let go of the idea. And this goes back to the question about left acceleration and right accelerationism. You know, the left accelerationists would say that we need to let go of the idea of jobs so we can liberate ourselves from toil, and that we can install, you know, fully automated luxury communism, or as we say sometimes, fully automated luxury gay space communism is the particular version of it that I like. You know, we should push as fast as we can, as hard as we can, as far as we can, because we're going to automate away the conditions of our own oppression. That's a left accelerationist argument. The right accelerationist argument is that all of those processes should be harvested in the name of maximized capital accumulation among the very smallest number of people, and everybody else can be bought off with a universal basic income and probably opiates. And, you know, that's sort of the right accelerationist end state. Virtual reality can replace opiates, you know, optionally in your version of the future. I think we completely have to reimagine what it is that we understand about our function on Earth, what it is that our bodies are for, what it is that our bodies are here to do, and what it is that our bodies can do together. And I hope, again, that that's a fair way of answering that question. I'm exhausted, and I bet you guys are too, and I bet you probably want to go eat and drink as much as I can. So what do you think?
Absolutely. I was about to bring this to a close in a very formal way.
You're the man. Do it.
And I wanted to do it with referring how dutifully I have prepared for tonight. I have read this book the last 2 weeks, the whole thing. I can recommend it. It's
Oh my God, dude! Okay, thank you.
No, seriously. So
that's an encomium I will remember and cherish.
It's highly accessible, and I'm saying this as someone who, for example, had to really go through your explanation of blockchain. At an absolute minimum, it's a very, very helpful navigation device for the area we are in, just to understand what the stuff out that is out there is about, how you can structure it, group it, frame it. Don't buy it on your Kindle. I've read this in all sorts of public spaces. People get incredibly curious if you do this.
Radical.
Do they really? And the final thought, if you then really read the whole thing, there's one very small sentence, which for me